Good morning. We might be thawing out now, but it was a week of this.
Is the sound of snow underfoot?
Oh yes, we were in the grip of a cold snap, a deep freeze, and for some counties in particular, it was stay-at-home snow days. On Monday's drive time, John Cook was out at a petrol station, McDermott's, in County Limerick, as people stocked up for the days ahead.
I'm from Patricksville.
How has the snow been so getting into town today?
It's been very, very bad. And it's supposed to freeze tonight now. And not long after I put it, it was desperate snow here altogether.
Yes, I can see it's still a very heavy snow. It's slushy trying to get in on the forecourt here.
Footpaths and all were lethal to the known world. We hadn't electricity for 19 hours.
Tough winter, so.
Oh, it is very, very hard. All I'm hoping for is we get a good summer.
How are you doing, sir? Can I give you a hand?
No, I'm okay.
John is my name. I'm from RT Radio 1. You're like a man who's going to light a fire.
I'd want to know anyone, wouldn't I?
You have bags of logs. You're laden down.
By the whole lot, boy.
You need a good fire these days.
Oh, well, that was bad, boy.
What's your plan for the big freeze of a week, so?
I might go off a few pints, stay indoors.
And light a good fire. Take care.
Oh, and well, you might have stocked up, because thousands of people were left without electricity or water. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Brian Tapley, ESB Networks Regional Manager, spoke to Mary.
Kerry, Limerick and Tipperary are kind of the worst affected counties in the country. Yeah, the conditions are challenging. For example, like in Newcastle West, the line feeding that village is damaged in several locations. And for us to gain access to repair that, we're having to, you know, bring our crews in by a helicopter each morning. So the conditions are difficult to identify the faults, to switch out the network and to do the repairs. And I suppose that's why it's taking us a number of days to get the last numbers of customers back.
And with Claire on Tuesday, Kate Durant. She runs the Muskerry News, and she talked about conditions in Blarney in County Kerry.
There's been a major water outage for 3 days for quite a substantial area in the village. They got it all back yesterday. Everyone was delighted, and it's gone again this morning. So you'd be worried about older people because, you know, you can't make a hot cup of tea. It's really bitterly cold here this morning, and there's no way you'd leave your house this morning and go down the road to get bottled water, because I just wouldn't chance the roads at the moment.
And while people waited for the lights to come back on and the taps to turn, others were preparing as best they could to provide shelter and warmth for those sleeping rough. On the News at 1, Rachel spoke to Katrina Toomey from Cork Penny Dinners.
They're all coming here. A lot of them are trembling with the cold when they come. And we're just giving them gloves and hats and neck scarves and warm, you know, thermal T-shirts and stuff. And giving them the hot food and giving them plenty of it so that they have enough food inside them and enough heat, like, to keep them warm. But, you know, it's difficult for them. Very, very difficult.
From the News at 1 on Tuesday, and if anything, it got colder before it eased off.
Met Aaron is forecasting that tonight may be colder than last night, when temperatures dipped to minus 5.7 degrees in some areas of the country.
Chilly. And all of the advice was to stay off the roads if at all possible. But if you did have to travel, you might be thanking our road gritters. On Wednesday, Brian O'Connell joined the crew. He was up early or never went to bed.
So, Brian, you had an early start, did you?
I did. 20 to 4 this morning, Claire. I think the last time I was awake at that hour was the 1990s. But anyway.
He was on the N20 from Blarney to Mallow, riding shotgun on a road gritter.
I felt like a 10-year-old kid just after 5 a.m. jumped into one of these large salting trucks. It was driven by Paul O'Connell, and he's been working really significant hours since last Friday when conditions began to worsen. And you could see really at 5 o'clock this morning, surfaces were quite icy given the drop in temperature overnight.
This is the third time tonight now the days are being treated.
And when the salt goes on the road, Paul, what happens is it doesn't allow the ice to form in normal circumstances.
No, see, we have a mixture. We have brine, which is a liquid salt. The salt mixed with water, and we have the granulated salt in as well.
Rock salt.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can see the road here. The surface has deteriorated significantly. We've just gone off the main road.
And I coming up now last night, it was -4 or -5 in the van.
the roads, they weren't gritted. You could see they were white.
So you've how many kilometres this morning to try and salt?
150 kilometres by the time I'll be finished. Just coming
back. A lot of long shifts done by many around the country this week. And as for farmers and their animals, it was a tough one. Claire spoke to Anne Graves, whose three brothers were up on the Galty Mountains pulling sheep out of snowdrifts.
They're out risking their sheep since last Sunday evening, along with their neighbouring hill sheep farmers. Basically, the sheep got they went into the hollows for safety and for shade, and the wind blew the snow on top of them. And so there's probably 5, 10, probably 15 feet of snow on top of them now.
My goodness. I mean, they survive in there, but they've been in there for days then.
They've been in there since last Sunday, yeah. So they have been, and as my brothers and my nephew and all the sheep farmers and the Galtys are walking, just trying to find them with their dogs, they might see, say, one their heads sticking up, and when they rescue that particular sheep, there's probably 5 more underneath them.
A grueling week for many. And with Oliver, a particularly difficult one for a family who absolutely needed to travel. Jo Harkins lives in Buin outside Mallow. Her 16-year-old son Kieran needed to get to Cork University Hospital on Monday for kidney dialysis. The snow, though, had other plans.
The very bad, so we'd between 8 to 10 inches, so there was no moving at all on the roads, anything. And I was going, what am I going to do? Jesus almighty, you know? What's going to happen, like? So at 9 o'clock in the morning, Cork University Hospital, yeah, one of the ladies then rang me and said, Jo, what way is the roads out there? And I said, they're very bad. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And she said to me, look, I'll get back to there. And she rang back in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And she said, actually, Jo, because we're going to send the army out. And I went, are you taking the piss? I thought they were actually joking, you know what I mean? I said, what? What do you mean?
But she was dead serious.
Dead serious? And I was going, they're joking. And she said, I've no idea what time, but they will come out to get, because she said, there's no cars are going on the roads at that, because they knew where I was, exactly. And these two lovely lads arrived at my door at around 1:15, Shane and Stephen Greycrack, and we mounted into the big pickup, green transporter.
Oh, brilliant.
Army Jeep.
Yeah.
And they brought us into Cork, and we Greycrack. Now, come here, isn't that arriving in style now?
That is, that's a memory, isn't it? In the big
it is,
snow,
yeah,
of
it was
25.
Fun, and they were laughing. No, the first 20 minutes going in along now wasn't fun at all. It was like going through the Alps.
Oh, wow, right.
And then from Blarney on, not a drop of snow, nothing.
Where did they come from Cork to get to you?
They came from Cork, yeah. One lad is from Cargill, and he was kind of going, you know, we're coming over here, no, there's nothing going on. But I mean, North Cork was on. Oliver, I'm not even joking. You couldn't believe it. The transformation was savage.
That's incredible. I can imagine the young soldier thinking, I'm going to be training now for very serious deployments.
Yeah, Shakiran thought we were going
to send me to
in the
Buin
truck.
In North
in
Cork.
Buin. Didn't even know where Buin is.
He didn't
you know.
Know
what I mean?
But obviously, it was a bit of crack going there, but this is for a serious appointment.
Great laugh.
Because he had to get his dialysis, doesn't he?
He had to get dialysis Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
All right, well, that's a huge...
So it wasn't a thing, I couldn't miss it. You know, it says, I'm getting my hair done, I can't go out. He has to go out.
Jer Harkins with Oliver, and fair play to the hospital and the army. And the snow did mean that some schools were forced to close. But some old enough to know better were putting on the brave face, making the best of it. Here's teacher, yes, teacher Servatius Antonius. I'm sorry, pardon? Servatius Antonius.
That's some name.
So I'm originally from the Netherlands, but I've been living in Ireland the last 23 years. So that's kind of like a Dutch name, really.
Ah, right. Because it sounds like something like a gladiator, doesn't it? Servatius Antonius.
That's what most people have been saying, yeah.
It's a brilliant name.
23 years of hearing that one, I suspect. He's on the radio, though, for making a snowman, and not just any snowman.
And what height does Big Bill stand at?
So Big Bill is 22 to 23 feet tall.
Wow, that's a tall snowman. And you reckon he's Ireland's tallest snowman this time round anyway?
Yeah, so I've researched, and do you know what? I can't find anyone that has a bigger snowman than Big Bill. So I assume that's the biggest snowman Ireland has ever seen.
Right.
Not to be outdone, Leaving Cert student Colin studying, no, building.
And what are the dimensions of your igloo?
Contender for line of the week.
It's around like 6 metres long and like a bit over 2 metres wide.
Right. And what possessed you?
Jesus, I couldn't really tell you. We were standing outside in the lawn, and it just came to the mind and just happened from there, I suppose.
As you do. Now, though, 'tis all turned to slush. Meanwhile, though, in California, wildfires raging. They ripped through Los Angeles, leaving at least 10 people dead, thousands of homes destroyed, and over 180,000 people ordered to evacuate their homes. On Wednesday's News at One, this report from LA-based journalist Steve Futterman.
I've covered fires for decades, and many of them here in Southern California. I've never quite seen a fire like this. The winds, we've had Santa Ana winds before, but they are so intense and so widespread. They are all over Southern California. The fire I've been covering is the main one, I guess, right now, the Pacific Palisades fire. And, you know, we've seen stories of people, again, we always hear these stories of people who, I'll stay at my home, I'll fight it. Not this time. People left. You had people abandoning their vehicles because there were traffic jams and the fire was moving towards them. That's how frightened people were. I've never seen a reaction like this. The Pacific Palisades and this area where I'm at right now, they estimate around 30,000 people have been evacuated. I don't find anyone sticking around to be the brave hero to save a home in this fire. It's just been overwhelming. The intensity, the swiftness of the fire, the flames moving so quickly, easily jumping across Pacific Coast Highway. And there are numerous homes, these beautiful homes, which, you know, I've seen for years driving along Pacific Coast Highway. These are beachfront homes, maybe the most valuable property in the world, most beautiful maybe. And these homes are destroyed one after another, after another, after another. It's quite a scene. And we're waiting for daylight to come where we'll really understand the intensity of the fire and the amount of the damage.
And helicopter reporter with ABC 7 LA, Chris Christie, described to Claire similar scenes he'd witnessed as people tried to escape the fire.
It was a really eye-opening experience for me because as the fire was breaking out, I, for the first time ever, was able to experience the pandemonium that sets in when people are literally running for their lives. They're packing their bags, they're packing their belongings with their essentials, and just being in the midst of that as the smoke was just blanketing the area. It's a really surreal scene when these fires break out and you see up close the frightening nature on the ground. People are just so desperate to get out. The traffic jams build up instantly, and it's pure chaos, really. Mm-hmm.
Months of drought coupled with the fierce Santa Ana winds are driving these fires. And with Claire, Lyndon Pronto, senior fire management expert at the European Forest Institute, and he's worked as a firefighter in California.
These types of major conflagrations in urban areas used to be a once in a career type of event when I started in 2007. And now over the last 10, 15 years, these have become increasingly common to the where it's every year as a firefighter in California, you're potentially dealing with a situation like this. And yeah, people are trying to get out. You're trying to figure out where to set priorities. It's a constantly evolving environment. It's extremely dynamic. You have curveballs coming your way. You have houses or garages that are exploding. The amount of hazardous materials people store in their garages, barbecues, there's outside propane tanks. It does feel like a war zone at times with, you know, gas lines exploding. There's a lot, and, you know, in this case in Southern California, one of the big issues is, you know, rolling rocks. So when the vegetation burns off the hillside, which is very steep, then you have a lot of rocks or even bigger boulders that come rolling down on top of you. And you've experienced that before. That's no fun at all because, you know, things happen without warning and you have to adjust your plans and be adaptive.
And Thursday's News at One brought us these voices from Los Angeles talking to the BBC.
Everybody's lost, not just this community, the community next door. I'm sure all the people up there have lost everything. It's just pretty devastating. I don't think LA's seen anything like this before.
The house goes on fire. Our house will definitely be next.
You look at something, you go, you know what? I've had that for almost all my life, but you know what? I can let that go.
I can let it go. I can let it go. And then I took photographs and things that meant something, a little figurine that my daddy bought for me when I was five, or, you know, some, those kinds of things.
I'll be okay. I'm tough, and we'll start
you
over. Even though I'm 91 years old, I'll start over again.
And the cost of the Los Angeles wildfires is being put at tens of billions of dollars. Also on the news at 1, it is official. 2024 was the hottest year on record. EU climate scientists at the Copernicus Climate Change Services say that the warming climate is beyond anything humans have ever experienced. Environment correspondent George Lee joined Keane.
What have we learned about the impact of all of this?
Well, we know that it's getting worse. We know that this is factual, it's not opinionated. We know that this is all evidence-based. We know that the amount of greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere is now at 422.1 parts per million. That's up 50% on what it was in pre-industrial times. And it hangs around for hundreds to maybe up to 1,000 years. And it keeps locking in the heat. And so we know that we're not going to find some solution to this global warming anytime soon. We're going to have to learn to live with it. And that's what Copernicus was saying in their briefing, that adaptation is really, really important. Those extreme weather events become more extreme, more frequent. And we have to learn somehow to take on board the fact that it's not going to disappear. And how do we adapt to that?
Well, how do we do that? What needs to happen next?
Well, I think for us locally, we have to recognise our own challenges, which would be in around flooding, in around, we're surrounded by water, we'll have extreme rain from time to time. We've seen evidence, say, more recently, I mean, some of the pictures I saw from Killybegs, what happened at the end of November when rivers burst and so on. We all know Middleton, what happened there. We know what happened in Clarenon Bridge. These are kind of extreme events which sometimes are localised, but we've seen the impact of them, and we've just been so lucky at times that we haven't had storm surges at the same time that we've had some of these extreme events. So putting in place flood defences in our cases, in many cases around the world, is putting in place methods in which people can live with that extreme heat. Heat is a huge killer globally and in every other way, and cities are going to have to adapt.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Expect to hear a lot about singer Maria Callas at the moment. Angelina Jolie is in the biopic. More in a bit. But first, let's take a listen to that voice. From Bellini's Norma. But is the film any good? Does Angelina put the diva in Casta Diva? For Arena reviewers Declan Burke and Deirdre Malumbi joining Kay, well, they were flinging the roses at this one.
So I think you both enjoyed Maria very much. For stars from you, Dee, did you think that both Angelina Jolie did a great job on it and that it's worth seeing?
Absolutely, yes to both. I think that there's excellent dialogue as well. We have to give credit here to Stephen Knight, wrote the screenplay. He's best known as the writer of Peaky Blinder. He gives some epic lines in this, such as, "I don't have to perform because everyone else is performing," which Maria says at one point. But yeah, extraordinary lead performance. And it's just a very, very moving picture.
Stars out of five from you?
4 out of 5 for me.
And from you, Declan?
Yeah, I think Angelina Jolie is perfectly cast, aloof, austere, elegantly brittle, and I think the film is sumptuous. So 4 stars for me too.
Well now, and that from a crew that don't normally go flinging stars around the place. And if you're looking for more information, check out this week's lyric feature from Liz Nolan, Maria Lacalas. And on Wednesday, more from Marina, this time a live special from the Lark Theatre in Balbriggan, a tribute to the work of Stephen Ray, from The Crying Game to working with Sam Shepherd and Samuel Beckett.
Yeah, and that meeting with Beckett, which I think has kind of was formative, definitely in this, if there's such a thing as a style of acting of Stephen Ray, but it was formative, I think, in the way you approach acting.
Oh, very much so, you know, because he, well, you know, his attitude was, don't think about meaning, think about rhythm. And that's the only note I would give anybody. You know, don't do your head worrying about what it means.
And ambiguity, I think he encouraged ambiguity.
Ambiguity, yeah. We said, it's always ambiguous.
And how did he go about saying that to you? I mean, it must have, being in the room with Samuel Beckett, even thinking about it, I think, would make me petrified.
Yeah, I was kind of petrified, all right, yeah. But listen, I'd been invited into the Beckett world, and I was inhabiting the role that my former mentor, Jack, had played. It was huge for me. And so I allowed myself a little fear and a little nerves, because it was a big learning experience.
And later, they got into this discussion about Neil Jordan's The Crying Game.
It was huge. And as Neil says himself, you couldn't make that film now because it's all out in the open.
Mm.
The whole trans thing and everything, you know.
But he was using that sexuality and gender studies, as well as the fact that the woman that he goes to meet in London is the wife of the soldier that he has held. Fergus, your character, has been holding this black British soldier as hostage, and that doesn't go well, and even though they become great friends. But Neil Jordan was kind of looking at Northern Ireland and nationalist politics and Irish politics in a very unusual and complex way.
Yeah, I like the way you separate Northern Ireland and Ireland, you know. That says a lot about your politics.
Oh, well, we're off.
Yeah, well, you see, the thing is that everything he was doing in that film was about identity, you know, challenging, you know, fixed ideas of identity. And that's what fascinated people, because it wasn't, it made everything less narrow, you know. And it's a truly tremendous piece of work. I saw it a couple of years ago, there was a new thing of it, and I just said, I wasn't going to watch it, but I watched it and then I said to Neil, it's a masterpiece.
Stephen Ray, as heard on the Arena special on Wednesday night. Now, it was 2021 that the Taliban took control in Afghanistan. And for women, life now is simply shocking. Here's Christina Lamb, Chief Foreign Correspondent, with Claire.
Women can't do pretty much anything. They can't go to beauty salons, they can't go to parks, they can't go to the gym, they can't speak out loud. The latest thing was that they can't even be seen at a window. You know, it really is a suffocating place, and it's terrible for women who were educated before and now are trapped and feel like all their dreams have been shattered. And it is terrible for young girls who, you know, are desperate to study and are just stuck, trapped at home.
So where is this
very hard line strategy coming from within the Taliban, if not all of them are in favour of it? Is there a particular faction that has decided that women should be suppressed in this way?
Yeah, I mean, one difference to the previous Taliban regime of the 90s, that was very monolithic. This time, there are clear factions. One of those factions is a very hardline faction based in Kandahar. Unfortunately, the supreme leader of the Taliban is from that faction, Haibatullah, and that's very ideological. And he's the person behind all of these rulings, and he's in charge.
And given the conditions under which women are being forced to live, where is the outrage?
Your female child or relative, from the age of 11 now, is really housebound. Not only that, but can't even stand at the window of that house.
No, I mean, it's absolutely suffocating for women living there, and not surprisingly has put a big strain on their mental health. And you know, we've seen a big spike in the number of young women taking their own lives because they just don't see any future for themselves. The whole thing is heartbreaking. I mean, to me, the idea that in 2025 there is a country in the world where girls cannot go to high school, women can't work or do any of these things. They even recently, women were still able to train to be midwives, because after all, the Taliban don't want men delivering women's babies.
Yes.
Right? But they even then banned that. So then this is completely confusing, because if you're saying women can only be treated by women, but you're not allowing women to actually train to be nurses, doctors, midwives, etc., what are they supposed to do? Having said that, you know, there are some grey areas. There are still women doing various things. There's some secret schools. I know that there's a woman running a secret driving school in her app for women. There are women still working in the main TV channel. They have to cover their heads. But at any moment, that could all be wound up. It's, you know, not, I think it's not tenable. It can't stay like this situation. I'm so glad that you're speaking about it, because one of the things I find very upsetting is that I feel like, you know, where is the outrage from the international community? At the beginning, there was, but now 3.5 years have passed. These girls are just, you know, seeing their lives going past and time being lost, and no one seems to really be doing anything about it.
Well, and you mentioned
Christina Lamb of the Sunday Times with Claire. With Oliver, a conversation we haven't heard very much so far. Adult children of sperm donors tracing their biological fathers. Louise McLaughlin is a journalist and host of the podcast You Look Like Me. She was born in the 90s and was told she was donor conceived when she was 13.
And at the time, growing up in Ireland, I had never heard the phrase donor conception before, let alone thought that it was something that could refer to me. And it would be, you know, over a decade before I knowingly met someone who was donor conceived. Obviously, I may have come into contact with people before that, but, you know, it was not a thing that people were speaking about. If you used a donor, you didn't necessarily tell anyone, even friends, close friends, family often didn't know. When you find out this information later in life, it pulls the rug out from underneath you. It changes everything. And people deserve to know the truth.
Now, today, under Irish law, a donor-conceived child can get the details of their donor when they turn 18, soon to be lowered to 16. But when Louise was conceived, this information was not always kept. She got a DNA kit and eventually found a half-sister.
I didn't speak about this until I found my half-sister, maybe 8 or so years ago. And when I met her, I just realised that I wanted to honour the relationship. I had waited so long to find her.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to ever be in a situation, say I got married, you know, and I was in a room with people and they said, oh, who's that? I didn't want to be like, oh, it's my friend, because it's not. It's my half-sister. I've waited half a lifetime to find this woman. She's amazing. So I wanted to really honour that relationship. And after I found her, I was like, well, I'm just going to start telling everyone. I'm going to start telling people I'm donor conceived.
And again, that you discover her through
online DNA testing.
Exactly.
I had to do it myself. I had to pay for it. I had to spit in a tube and send it off and hope for the best. And I was sitting on that DNA site for years before I got a match, you know, and that's painful as well. But when I found her, I realized I wanted to honor the relationship, and I wrote an article, and, you know, I just got this huge feedback from all over the world of people going, you know, looking into the mirror and not knowing who half of you was. They get, well, no one's ever said it that way. You know, I've always felt it, but I haven't seen that written down before. And I realized there was such a space where these perspectives were just not being covered as a result of a lot of the shame that kind of exists in that space.
And then she and her half-sister would go on to find their biological father.
You know, again, after a decade and a half, suddenly in one night, you have a match that leads you to him. And within hours, I had found his website with the help of my half-sister, and I had a contact number, and I called him.
And what a rush that was to suddenly...
Yeah.
He had a website, so presumably there's a photograph.
There was a photograph. There was a video. He's a dance teacher, so there was a video of him dancing. And he just looked like both of us, you know, really? Like the title of my podcast, You Look Like Me. It's these things when you come face to face with a biological match, mm-hmm. it's amazing what you see in yourself. And mannerisms, it's not always physical, you know, it's just the way you move, the laugh. But yeah, we found him and I cold called him. And, you know, we could have, we talked about, do you send an email? You know, if he's going to respond to us, he'll do it, whether it's email, whether it's call. And people don't, you know.
Quicker with a phone call.
It's quicker with a phone call.
Because you're risking rejection, which can be hugely traumatic.
And also you get a rejection in real time, at least if it's a phone call, you know. Whereas if you send an email, you're just sitting there, it becomes a waiting game again, which is what I've been doing. But yeah.
So you do it, you call.
I called him and I recorded the phone call because I didn't know if that was the only time I would speak to him. And Jess is, you know, live texting me. But she's never going to hear this man's voice if he says, I don't want to know you people.
Okay.
So I record the phone call and he was amazing. He welcomed us. He is very spiritual. So he was very happy to be found. And we met up with him a month later. But when he donated, he was never given a choice to not be anonymous.
He was going about his business that day. And
he was on a beach in Greece, really? You know, and he gets a phone call from someone saying, I think I'm your daughter. By the way, there's another one.
Wow. What was his reaction?
He said, you've caught me by surprise, but you are very, very welcome to have found me.
And it would turn out she has many, many more half-siblings out there.
It went well for you. Does Neil, your dad, your biological father, does he know how many children have been born from his
We have absolutely donation? No idea. So I have found, seven half-siblings, I think.
Seven?
Yes, so far.
And have you been in contact with all of them?
No. No.
You just know that they exist out there.
Yes. There's been a recent discovery, which was three at once, which was a lot, but we have not been in contact with them.
And Louise McLaughlin talked about navigating all of this with her own parents, as well as developing a relationship with her birth father.
You've kind of got some sort of a relationship with them now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's strange in itself because I didn't want another father. I had the best father. You know, I still have the best father, but he was wonderful growing up. You know, there was never a lack there. But I just, maybe it's my journalist hat, maybe it's the desire to know where we come from. And the huge feeling of injustice that I had a right to know where I came from. So, finding him, it just answered a lot of questions that, funnily enough, had been semi-answered by finding Jess. You know, okay. Even that one biological match was important and it did answer a lot. When I found her, I did think, you know, maybe this is enough for me. But finding him has been great, yeah. And we are building to a relationship. I don't know what the relationship, how would you define it? I don't really know. But I am cautious that through this podcast and through telling this story, I am really in the minority of people who come out of these things with a happy
finding
ending.
Finding out, okay.
Finding out or finding out and being accepted.
Being accepted.
You know, people get restraining orders. As I mentioned earlier, wow. People find a donor to find out they've already passed away. There are horror stories that come out of this industry. And this is why, again, I would advocate for openness, honesty, allow people to track down these biological connections as early as possible, if they choose to. Many people might not.
Louise McLaughlin with Oliver. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Not long now until the inauguration of one Donald Trump, and yesterday, guilty maybe, but no jail time or a fine for his payment of hush money to an adult film actress. So on we go. And he was making headlines all over the place this week with his pronouncements on foreign policy. Wouldn't mind a bit of Greenland and maybe the Gulf of Mexico. Change that to the Gulf of America. Better ring to it. And while eyebrows might be raised in some circles at the incoming president, others are keen to get on board the Trump train. Yes, we're talking to you, Mark Zuckerberg. This week, he announced the appointment of Dana White of the UFC to the Meta board, just after Nick Clegg had left. Tom Lyons, business journalist with The Currency, joined Claire.
Do you think it'll be a big shock that Dana White has been appointed to the board?
I think he, you know, his background is in men fighting in a cage. Mm-hmm. It's not immediately, you think, applicable to the metaverse, AI, and that type of stuff. But Dana White is clearly somebody who is very smart, and he has used social media very effectively to grow these businesses. He's also involved in wrestling. He's also involved in power slap, which is large men and women slapping each other in the face in order to knock each other out. So he's somebody who's seen how he had the power of these social media platforms. So he certainly understands Zuckerberg's business. But I think, you know, if you look at Nick Clegg versus Dana White, they're two very different people, and they come from very different ends of the political spectrum. And I think Dana White going onto the board is a clear signal from Mark Zuckerberg that he's moving in the direction of that the president is going to, that the US president is going to take the country.
And you're saying that we should watch the other tech companies as well moving in the same, this is the direction of travel, right, towards Trump, showing him, look who I have hired, I am your friend.
Very much so. They all see how, like if you look at Elon Musk, who's led the way on this, you know, funding Trump's campaign at vast expense to himself, and you look at his constant pushing of Trump's message on X. We're seeing all the other companies rowing in behind that. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Meta, Amazon, OpenAI, they're all funding Trump's inauguration fund. We've seen Apple meet with Trump as well. Like, they're all very much saying that this time around, we're going to be on your side.
Or, as he rather pithily put it...
Well, I think they're showing the character of billionaires, which is ultimately to stay billionaires.
And then news that Facebook was shutting down its external fact-checking facility, all to be replaced by the equivalent of community notes, favoured by guess who? X. And it was Elon Musk who was causing controversy this week. He hosted an interview with the leader of the far-right Alternative for Germany party, Alice Fidel, on his personal X account. Musk has over 200 million followers. Mary put this to Dr. TJ McIntyre, Assistant Professor of Law at UCD and Chairperson of Digital Rights Ireland.
What, if anything, is wrong with Elon Musk using, the owner of X, using his platform to host the leader of the AFD?
As regards what's wrong with this, the concern legally is that under a law called the Digital Services Act, platforms have to be essentially neutral in how they approach the material that they carry. The allegation here is that Elon Musk has put his thumb on the scales by using X to promote his tweets and promote these kinds of far-right talking points.
He's been doing that and doing it liberally in recent times. We have seen him roundly criticise Keir Starmer and his government in the UK, casting slurs, to put it at its mildest perhaps, in the direction of Starmer and his safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips. He's been criticising Olaf Scholz as well. We haven't seen a response from Europe, or we haven't seen implementation of the act that you're talking about, TJ. And I suppose my first question on that is, what's behind it? Is it to rein in the European Commission and rein in attempts to rein them in?
I think that's absolutely fair. So his actions and related actions by Meta have been prompted by EU investigations, not just under the Digital Services Act, but also under competition law, the GDPR, etc. And American tech firms now collectively believe that Europe is possibly the only entity left that can control their power. And they're worried about that. And I think this is part of that backlash.
Leaving that there for now. But if we are in a world driven to make everything great, what if we could just be content with Schutz Grand? Patrick Frayne joined the Darcy. The Irish Times journalist has written about burnout and just being average.
I think it was particularly when I was looking at those young people's kind of social media feeds, everyone's being encouraged to be the best all the time. And the reality is, like, most of us can only be average most of the time. Like, occasionally we all excel at different things.
Yes.
For a bit. But, like, the very nature of the word average.
Oh, but that's it, because there it's that curve, isn't it? So yeah. Most of us are in the middle there. It's only the few or at the extremities there.
Yeah.
But what about the best version of yourself, Patrick?
well, this is part, like...
No, but that is a phrase yeah. that's used, isn't it? Constantly. It's been thrown at us.
But even that, I feel, puts pressure. Like, I think that 10, 20 years ago, like 30 years ago, I think people had a better understanding of this. Like, I think that we need hobbies, we need community, we need time off. We need time that isn't productive. Like, our modern culture, there's an obsession with productivity, and definitely with me, but I think with a lot of other people too, because that piece got a bigger reaction than any yeah. piece I've done in years. And it was all from people who went, I thought I was going mad, you know, because everyone felt like they were chasing something impossible.
And with all of this work, 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 we end up feeling more fraught and poorer in every area of our lives.
I think we need to remove, kind of culturally remove a few things. Like some of
it is... capitalism. Just like that, here we go.
Well, like even capitalism, I think you can, like there's a really simplistic narrative that like, you know, and I have it in my piece, yes. like hyper-capitalism where more and more of the rewards of our productivity is going to a smaller and smaller cohort of people. That's not great. Nice capitalism, like the local shop and the bookshop, that's all fine. That's all part of our community. And I think that having a more community-focused society, like having our society built more around our actual needs rather than the kind of needs that were devised by a certain kind of type A psychopath who is constantly chasing after things and thinks that all of the rest of us should be running at that pace all the time.
And in Frayne's view, to pin it all on the individual rather than a system, well, maybe just what the man wants.
I think one of the issues now, and I think it's one of the issues with the productivity thing, is that in the absence of analysing why our society can't provide more of the things it used to provide for people, like housing, like yeah. at the, you know, back when we were a very poor country, we were building large amounts of social housing.
Yeah.
Instead of asking those questions, there is a focus put on the individual now increasingly. And I think that's part of where the burnout feeling comes from, because instead of going, actually, it's collectively that we build good lives. It's not individually. It's not purely individually that you build a good life for yourself. That if you don't have the support of your society or your, like, so on, you don't have the support of your family. Some people do and some people don't. If you don't have the support of the wider society to build a life for yourself, it's yeah. not enough to be doing it on your own. And I think that then there is, like, if you look at the messaging around all those gurus and all that, there's not enough focus, I think, on the wider systemic thing and the fact that it's as a collective that we usually make good lives.
Patrick Frayne with the Darcy. Well, after all that, it has been quite the week. So any opportunity for cheap titters, yeah, we'll take it. Cormac, Sarah Balls, specifically the football that flew, ooh, a little bit differently. Tricky. For apparently that was the reason Arsenal lost to Newcastle. Well, according to Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta, Roddy Collins had some choice words for him.
That was laughable. I couldn't believe what I was hearing, you know. but that's a man under severe pressure.
Yeah.
And he's used every excuse in the book. And when it came to that one, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. And I just thought to myself, but you see, he should be put to sword live on TV, but they're all in the same little gang together. Sky, the managers, the players, they all read off the same hymn sheet, you know. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that, you know.
I do wonder, though, because you do see, for example, in tennis, you see the tennis players often they'll bounce a ball and then they'll throw back to the ball person and pick another ball. Like, they have their favourite balls. You know, like, players can be...
Sounds like an excuse.
But they do. No,
Sarah, there's a standard ball for whatever, a European competition, yeah. A standard ball for Premier League, you know, because I've played in the League of One, then in Europe, and they changed the ball a week before, blah, blah, blah. Look, at the end of the day, two teams played the same ball. The Newcastle ball went into the net. The Arsenal ball didn't go into the net, so therefore it was a defected. Okay. You know, it's a fallacy. It's laughable.
Okay. Well, I still think that some people have their famous balls or favourite balls, but neither of you two.
Come on, Sarah, to stop.
So does Roddy.
But anyway, okay. Now look,
we'll leave it there before it's too late. Game ball, exactly.
Never too clever for a ball joke. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. That's the football one, isn't it? Or is it the cricket?